It's been 4 days since Syrian President Bashar al-Assad fled the country.
And celebrations are settling down. People there are starting to think about the huge challenges facing the war-torn country.
NPR's Ruth Sherlock is in Damascus, and she's here to tell us more. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning.
So what's the situation there like now?
Well, you know, you might be able to hear the high-caliber rounds being fired behind me. It's the rebels testing weaponry they've acquired. But apart from these explosions, they seem to be trying to keep a pretty light touch here, Michelle. You know, they've swept down from this rural province of Idlib, and they seem to be trying to show Damascenes, people from here, that they can go about their business. And there's not even a lot of checkpoints, for example. And what is quite extraordinary is they seem to now be handling a relatively managed handover of power. They've formed this new transitional government, and this even includes some politicians from the old regime. They're pardoning soldiers who were conscripted into the military service, but they are dismantling the feared security apparatus, the intelligence bases of the regime, and saying that they will bring war criminals to justice. A lot of the new faces in this new government are similar to those in the Islamist-led government in the rebel-held province of Idlib that they controlled for years. They are projecting moderate stances for now, saying women can dress as they please, for example. But, you know, many Syrians say it's still really too early to know how this will go.
So we mentioned earlier that the city seems to be quieting down. What are you hearing about people's main priorities right now?
Well, look, a big priority here is the missing. You know, this regime ruled with fear, and rights groups estimate tens of thousands of people disappeared into prisons and detention centres of the regime's main intelligence agencies. And under Assad, their families weren't even told, you know, where they were being held, why they were being held, or even if they were alive. So we went to Sednaya prison. That's one of the most feared complexes, known for torture, mass executions. And now it's just open. You can walk right in. And the prisoners were released by rebels in the first hours after the regime fell. But so many more are still missing. And now the prison is full of relatives. They're searching for clues about their loved ones that were taken in jail. And mainly, you know, maybe trying to find some kind of closure. One elderly man, Ratib Zamilkani, he was walking away from the prisoners we walked up. And he had this rope tied like a noose in his hand. And he said he believed this was used to hang prisoners. He's saying, why did they have to put my son in cells underground? Where is he? Asks. And he tells us he took the noose from the prison to show the world the cruelty of the Assad regime.
There's some really disturbing pictures coming from there. So Ruth, under the old regime, there was a lot of foreign involvement in Syria, mainly from Russia and Iran, but even the U.S. had troops there. What is the latest with all these different players?
Well, Israel has carried out hundreds of airstrikes in Damascus and around to stop what it calls strategic weapons from falling into the wrong hands. The Russians still have their air base here and a naval port in Syria's Tartus. And the Americans are still here with a mission to help Kurdish allies fight the extremist group ISIS that is still operating in the central Syrian desert. So there are a lot of foreign countries involved here still.
That is NPR's Ruth Sherlock in Damascus. Ruth, as always, thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Here's some of what we know about Luigi Mangione, the man accused of killing the CEO of United Healthcare last week on a Manhattan sidewalk.
He's a member of a prominent Maryland family. Mangione graduated top of his class from an elite prep school and received 2 degrees from an Ivy League school. He also reportedly suffered a major back injury and underwent surgery a couple of years ago. Investigators and some extremism researchers have been sifting through this picture to see whether there's evidence of a clear ideology behind the killing.
NPR's Odette Youssef covers domestic extremism, and she's here with us now to tell us more. Good morning, Odette.
Good morning, Michelle.
So you've looked at some of Mangione's social media, and you've spoken with others who have as well. What did you learn?
Well, he appeared to keep several accounts on sites including X, Facebook, and Goodreads. And there are a few things that raise questions. On his Goodreads account, for example, he posted an excerpt from the writings of Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. So we might wonder how that may relate to a trajectory toward political violence. Also, one of the pictures on his X account banner is an X-ray of a spine with 4 large screws inserted in what looks like major surgery. Now, we don't know for certain that this is his X-ray, but there are reports that he may have sustained this injury in a surfing accident in Hawaii. But all told, Michelle, his digital footprint really doesn't clarify much because it cut off in the spring. Here's Jared Holt of the Institute for Strategic Dialogue.
And 6 months is a long time for somebody to radicalize further, for them to fly off the rails, maybe have a mental health crisis. I mean, we could speculate on 100 different things, but there's a big, big gap in what happened in those 6 months.
Oh, you know, according to the police, he was found with a handwritten note. NPR has not obtained a copy, but other news outlets say they have, and they've printed it or portions of it. From what you've seen, does it fill in some of those gaps?
Well, from what's been shared by other reporting, this short note conveys a deep anger toward the healthcare industry and a feeling that someone had to do something about it. But other than that, no. You know, if some of this ties back to a possible injury that he had and perhaps what he ran into while trying to get care, it doesn't make any of those connections. Now that he's in custody, I imagine we're going to learn much more. But there is another part of this that's troubling, and that part is the valorization that we're seeing of the suspect within some of the mainstream public.
Can you say more about that? What does that look like?
So this killing, you know, seemed to tap into the feeling that seemingly most Americans have had at one time or another of frustration and helplessness with the healthcare industry. What really struck me, though, is that I have typically seen people who commit mass violence or political violence praised, even venerated as martyrs, in really kind of dark corners of the extremist world, you know, within online communities that emulate mass shooters, for instance, or in violent white supremacist spaces. So seeing a much wider and mainstream public call this suspect a, quote, hero is troubling. And for extremist analysts that I spoke to, you know, this really kind of speaks to how Americans have, over time, become more open-minded toward political violence.
That's NPR's Odette Youssef. Odette, thank you.
Thank you.
It's a 1-2 punch for the grocery mega merger of Kroger and Albertsons.
Yeah, two separate judges have blocked the $25 billion grocery deal. It would have been the biggest in U.S. history, but now its fate is up in the air.
NPR's Alina Selyuk is here with more. Good morning, Alina.
Good morning.
Okay, so two judges ruling at once. How'd that happen?
Yeah, it was a federal judge in Oregon and a state judge in Washington, two separate cases. They just ruled within about an hour of each other. Just so happened. The state judge ruled the merger violates state consumer protection law. The federal case blocked the merger nationwide. And technically, the block is temporary, and technically, Kroger and Albertsons can keep fighting. They can appeal both rulings. They have, however, been at it for over 2 years, and this double whammy of legal losses is really looking like it could be the death knell for the merger.
Well, 2 years. So remind us the details of this deal.
Yeah, it was in late 2022 when Kroger first said it would buy Albertsons for nearly $25 billion. This would combine the two biggest supermarket chains in the U.S. You might actually know these chains under different names. Kroger runs Ralph's, Harris Teeter, Fred Meyer, King Soopers, others. Albertsons owns Safeway and Vons, thousands of stores. They knew this merger would be a tough sell for regulators, and immediately they said, you know, we're ready to fight in court, bring it on. And that is what happened. That guy, they got sued three times by Colorado, which is still pending, by Washington, and by the Federal Trade Commission, along with a bunch of states, all asking courts to block the merger.
Tell us more about the arguments in court.
So government lawyers argued Kroger and Albertsons often compete head-to-head. They keep tabs on each other's prices, store hours, quality of products, and that, you know, putting two rivals under one roof would leave shoppers worse off. Fewer choices, higher prices. Now, Kroger and Albertsons made the case that the merger for them was a matter of survival, that their biggest rivals are not conventional supermarkets like each other, but giants like Walmart, Costco, Amazon. They said only together could they actually compete with these companies long term. They argued that together they could actually have more power to lower prices for shoppers.
And evidently the judges did not buy that argument.
They did not. The U.S. district judge wrote essentially that she understood that competition with Walmart is real and it's tough, but it cannot justify an otherwise illegal merger. The judges also did not buy the company's plan to create essentially a new rival for themselves. That was a plan that Kroger and Albertsons had for markets where they currently overlap. They'd proposed selling hundreds of stores in those areas to another company to run as a new competitor chain. The federal judge in particular found that company was inexperienced and was not getting set up for success.
So apologies if I'm asking you to speculate, but does this mean that this is the end of the merger?
Well, so what we know so far from the companies, they've just said they are disappointed, they disagree with the courts, and that they are evaluating their options. But there is a pretty high chance Kroger walks away, which would then mean Albertsons would probably put itself up for sale again, try to find someone else to buy it. And overall, you know, this has been, it's been 2 years. It has been very expensive and a fairly unpopular deal, criticized by both Democrats and Republicans. Shoppers using it to air grievances about expensive groceries. And for now, those shoppers can keep going back to their familiar grocery stores.
That is NPR's Alina Selyukh. Alina, thank you.
Thank you.